is the subject matter, is the spiritual life a science or a philosophy? The time is 7:30 p.m. and it will be at the Maricopa Ramada at Fort Tuthill. Most of you may or may not know how to get there, so I'll tell you. You travel 89A towards Sedona and turn right at the main entrance to Fort Tuthill. And Maricopa is the first Ramada on the left, and the time, again, is 7:30. There is ample parking available, but be sure to bring coats or sweaters and probably a flashlight. And since there are no admission charges to the lecture tonight, we'll welcome any goodwill offerings that you'd care to make in the basket by the door as you go out. And there'll be somebody there to accept those donations. Thank you, and I'll turn the rest of the evening over to Dr. Lay for questions and answers.
Thank you, Marcus. It's not a school, it's a clinic where we do holistic therapy for people who have problems. They've tried every other form of therapy and then they come to us. We don't go out to try to heal people. The questions come up, have you tried the regular medical profession first? Have you gone to all the required modalities? And if they've tried and there is no correction, we offer an opportunity to see if we can make you look at it more objectively. And if in doing that, it is corrected, that's how we operate.
Are you teaching or?
No. Well, let's say, for instance, a person calls on the phone and says, I'd like to speak to Adano, all right? What's your problem? I have an ache in my back. I said, how long you had it? Have you been to the regular professional doctors who've checked it out? Yes. They don't find anything wrong. All the x-rays show there's nothing actually physically wrong there. Yet the pain is there. It keeps repeating itself, and I am unable to perform my work. Then I would say, I can't do anything for you over the phone. If you want to come, I will check it out. And if we can't do anything for you, we'll try and recommend who would be the proper or a competent person to help you in it. So they show up. Then we check them out. 9 times out of 10, it is corrected. 1 out of 10, they have to be referred to other competent people to do it. But 9 times out of 10, they do have a recession or in the problem, and they're able to cope with it and correct it, and it phases out. But that's and once a month, on the last Sunday of the month, if I'm there, if I'm not there, different. But when I'm there, we have a workshop in nutrition, how to eat properly. See, if you don't know how to eat properly, you can get sick. And most of our illnesses begin from improper eating. You see, that's one of the indications in your biblical writings. When man was made, what would he eat? And so he was told what to eat, but never brought forward into a workable science. And so many of the people that show up at the clinic usually have a lot of problems that are related to nutrition, more so than injuries. And then they have to be shown how to reassess their diet, and then they get well. But that's what we, yeah. Anything else?
Wanting to find out if you are doing like workshops or retreats.
This retreat was for these folks here. I left there to come up here and spend time with the folks here that are living here. But I usually have there is for just a clinic. And we have the workshop on nutrition on the Sunday, last Sundays of the month. It's mostly a preventative process. Yeah, this girl, maybe.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could expound a little bit on the inner library that you talked about, how to get to the inner library or understand
The Akashic Records, or the cohesive memory bank of the intercellular mechanism, can be tapped when you slow the brain down to about 12 cycles a second. Normally, anything above 25 is considered the beta level. When you lower it down below 25, you enter the alpha, but you really can't tap the memory bank at that level. It's a little too fast. Memory precipitation begins anything from 12 down to 4. Now, very few people can drop to 12, and those who can drop to 12 begins to tap the memory bank. Now, the breathing will drop down. That's why one of the handicaps of meditation is that you're busy arguing with yourself and wondering if you're not breathing fast or you're breathing too slow. This dialogue interferes. There's a very good reason why it's there. Your toxicity ratio may be the impedance for you to lower, and if you drop too fast, you may disturb some of the transport time of the minerals in your body to certain organs, and therefore you may go into a spasm. Now, it could be speeded up, like at a Pentecostal movement. You go from 30 cycles down right to about 7 cycles very fast, and they push you over. You know, you're, what do you say, zapped by God, the Holy Spirit. you fall right over and you're in that state. But your whole memory bank comes crashing in on you. And time stands still, verbalization stands still, and it's all photography. But you have a problem trying to pick up the pieces, and yet it's an enlightenment, and the concentrated fluids in the body that are so highly refrigerated and suppressed by the different images over the years of anguish come gurgitating out like a volcano. And you start crying, you can't hold back this. And sometimes they have to haul you and keep you in a corner and try to get you to get back. But that's very drastic in terms of the meditative life. But it's valid in terms of that it does exist. Going into it objectively, bit by bit, under your own control, it takes little time to get down to that level. But when you get to that level, you will start opening up as you gain more control. It's a whole lot better to go down slower and gain control than to be thrown into it that fast and then you don't have control. It's like a person dropping into the water to swim and goes to certain depths. He'll go down, but he can't come up fast. If he comes too fast up, you'll get the bins. And that's reversed now in terms of what is in meditation. If you try to drop yourself down too fast, you get the psychological bins. You see what I mean? So you have to know what you're doing. So you don't want to go down too fast. You see? Then as you gradually work your way up, then you'll be able to come back up progressively. And the important thing to remember that when you're slowing down, always have, if you don't have any way to relate to any human being as a touch base, it's like we'll say an anchor to a boat, then have something in reference to what you want to do after you finish your meditation. If you say, I'm going to meditate for the next hour, and try to go down to that level, and after that hour I'm going to go out and do such and such a work, that built-in program is a safety factor to a locking in of yourself in a range that you may not be competent in, and it will fire you back out. So this is your own safety factor, is how you program back in yourself to come back on a conscious level. So always be certain that if you say, and I'm going to meditate, I'm going to get up and do this and that. But do it. When you get up, don't fail to do it, because then it'll trick you and knock you out and let you down. That's where you learn sooner or later you have to live your word. So don't make statements about yourself, what you will do after meditation, and don't do it. Even try your best to do it and finish it. Then the consciousness will take over and fulfill and will allow you to slip down into that level. Mr. Casey used to do that a lot. Even he would lie on a book and all the data of the book would be in his brain. But then he'd say, I'm going to use this to do my work. Because if he didn't, he got locked into it. Yes, somebody.
Yeah, I find when I get to that point where you stop the inner dialogue, the problem becomes, I immediately say to myself, oh, it's stopped.
Guilty! You got company.
I've been along the whole program in the last 20 minutes of getting there. And I thought maybe there would be some suggestion you might have as to how you can wedge yourself in there and keep yourself more quiet. Quiet longer. I know that may be the process of a lifetime test. But, you know, what I find is that it's almost as though at this point in my life, I part of me becomes afraid of that silence or this uncomfortableness, and I'm not quite sure what I could maybe do to not talk to myself about how quiet I'm being.
Well, from my own experiences and all the other researchers, including Dr. Lilly, in his latest book, The Eye of the Cyclone, you must make necessary verbal programs for what you expect to do after you proceed to experiment on the inner level. You must have something to refer back as an anchoring system. No captain will take to sea without an anchor in his boat. And when he comes into the shoreline, that anchor has to be there to hold it to the wall. So there is certain terms or ideas that we have to anchor into. And that is where desire to perform service is a natural and a rational anchoring for the brain after researching into the self. You must set up some desire to perform some type of service that is natural to your mechanism. Then this will suspend that I am silent now. Because that is what the brain was looking for in the first place. What would you do if you got all this silence, and then where are you going to apply it? You see what I mean? Yeah. So if you program that you will apply your attention to something constructive after you go in that state, and the idea is to make whatever you're going to apply yourself to will flow easier in the process of application, you'll see there's a definite link now for the first time by setting up the programming. For instance, all right, you spend an hour or whatever length of time to come to a suspension of the dialogue. But before you started, you say to yourself, I am going to go into my consciousness to tap possible new ideas how to work on this piece of equipment or this particular problem in my daily life, and I want to get in there to have access to that reservoir of information, and then that it flows in rational, logical, when I come out in the application. You have to do that. So then you shut off and you go in and you sit. And you wait for the internal dialogue to shut down. Then the creative nature will come up. Now, if the experience for that particular need is to occur within that specific day or time, it will come up very fast. If the experience is not to occur, but let's say in a week from now, it will give you portions of it, pushing you into a whole week to finalize the experience. You follow what I'm saying? The data will not come flowing through ahead of its time. You may get a preview of what is possible, but it will not come up. So it progressively you'll get portions of it coming up for you to cope with what you're doing on the rational level. And therefore, you have control now for the first time that you can actually relate back inside and say, I am now going to bring this forward onto my consciousness and apply it. But you must set up something to do, otherwise you're tapping the reservoir without any purpose. It's like you go into your savings account to use it and there is no bill to pay. Now if you had a checking account and there was a deficiency in the checking account because you paid out a check and the check is going to be short, you can draw from your savings to fulfill the deficiency on the checking account. But something has to be missing in order for the other one to be valid for it to be released. And if you do that outwardly, the same is going to go on inwardly, because our outward behavior is only a reflection of the internal mechanics. And the two can't be in conflict. It makes you more aware of how you're set up. So if you're going to create a demand and place a locking in to the supply area, which is the internal portion of your mechanism, you have to set up a demand for it to be able to feed from that level to what you need to apply. But you can't just say, I'm going to go in there, and then when you get there, there's nothing for it to do, and naturally it's going to confront you and say, well, what did you cut me in here for?
I can really relate to the checking account example. I wanted to ask you also, I have an isolation tank and I do use it for meditation, and I was interested in your comments about it being an inappropriate way to begin meditation and wonder when it might become appropriate, or if that's a different situation altogether.
No, as long as you set up a demand of what you will do with the energy after you tap it, and what is necessary to perform that demand, that is a valid way to program yourself. You must set up the demand. You see, necessity or demand is the mother or origin or the required condition for inventiveness or creativeness. You couldn't draw from the source or reservoir if there is no demand. What would you do with it? It's like you don't have any bills to pay. Would you take out your money to do what? You're only going to draw it out when there is something to pay. Otherwise, you leave it there to accrue. And that's exactly what you're doing with the mechanism. That's why a lot of doctors will tell you you're only using a very small portion of your brain potential. We don't have demand levels sufficient enough to keep pulling upon the brain potential. We have to generate demand levels. So meditation is the opportunity to go in, assess the account, assess the reservoir, and at the same time, recognize the demand level. Now, I'll give you an example in the comment I made earlier about this hotel in reference to Yogananda, the Cadillac. He was in a brand new Cadillac, that year's model. And yet the man was saying in his mind, how come if he's such a spiritual person, why is he riding in a Cadillac? And he turns around and addressed the man by saying, Mr. Johnson, I didn't ask for the Cadillac. It was given to me. And then he makes the comment, in fact, it's a very poor expression of man's creativity, looking forward to a better model next year. By virtue of this, he laid the groundwork for what? creativity to flow to whoever is on the intake or the lock-in, to have a design or an idea flow up to that brain. So the person who was instrumental in giving him the vehicle would be also be recipient of this energy flowing back to them as a way to let them be more inventive. This is true of Jesus when he said, the things I do, you do also. But he didn't say, not greater than I, and not more or less. He's already saying, the things I do, you do also. But then he goes on, and greater things shall you do. What is that laying the foundation for? That's laying the foundation for more demand on the creative nature in us. It's like an anchorage for outlet. You have to set it up, otherwise it would not work. You have access to this reservoir, but if you don't set up what the demand is for it, it's not going to release it. Once you realize that, then it will come forward quicker. But until you realize that, you'll always shut it off by the statement, well, I'm no longer talking, what happens next? You see, the expectancy hasn't been resolved. You have to set up something to resolve expectancy. Then it is automatically supplying you with data. What are my views on reincarnation? It's valid. It would be highly impossible to create a universe and not have opportunity to resolve your mistakes. Now, let's say, for example, you're endowed with the power to command anything you want to eat to appear. And so you command a tomato to appear. And you plant it in the ground because you would like to eat another one. But by the same token, then instead of another tomato coming up, a squash came up. You would call your friend and say, this is a fantastic thing. This is the greatest miracle. I planted a tomato and I got a squash. They'll all agree with you. Yet, if you eat the squash, there is no more squash to be had. If you plant the squash and corn came up, now you're in a quandary. You don't have any squash to eat and you can't vouch that you have a squash. Now you see, it would be impractical for a creative intelligence to work through such a law of surprise element without recurrence. Recurrence would be a functional law that if you plant a tomato, you're going to get a tomato. But to plant a tomato and get a squash, and then you can't eat the squash because there will be no more squash to plant, it leaves you in a quandary. So reincarnation is only a natural law of nature from the atomic level right down to the cellular level for cleansing the process of organisms that may delay their internal accomplishments. Now, for instance, let's say you're born and you make a lot of mistakes, and you make some mistakes you don't make, you didn't. So in total of your life, 60 or 70 years, you may have had 15 non-corrected mistakes. But life terminates at you for 65. You don't have a chance to correct or make up for those 15 or 16 mistakes. All the others have been corrected so far. And here you pass on, not correcting that mistake. The account can be closed. If in a physical, rational way, you wouldn't do that to somebody who owes a company money, they're going to send what? A bill collector to their ears, right? To collect the bill. Since the ears are your own soul nature, you will have to come back in some physical form to compensate for that bill. And Eastern people would call that karma. The farmer calls that sowing or reaping. And Newton will call it, for every action is equal and opposite reaction. Now, it's valid in this sense that you do something, and if you don't complete it, you have to complete it at some other time. Now, if any reference to such an idea doesn't exist in other parts of scriptural writings or in other belief systems, and if you look at physics from its own structure, and this phenomena of repetition and self-correction is not inherent in repetition, then reincarnation is invalid. The word reincarnation means merely to do it over again and correct it. Now, to him that overcometh, I will not send forth a second time. Is this your first 100 million time? I once met a great Swami that came from India, and this is how he greeted me when he walked in the room. Hi, brother, of 150,000 incarnations. And everybody looked. Well, he recognized me as a brother of his, over 150,000 incarnations. Now, that kind of blew a lot of people's mind out of focus, because here is a realized man who is able to look at me straight off, and we're meeting for the first time, and making the comment. You see? All right. Let's take the story of Cain and Abel. Adam and Eve had a child called Cain, and another child called Abel. And it is said that the one brother killed the other brother. Now let's picture for one moment, there are only four people living. Where is the justice of the dead brother going to be resolved because the other brother killed him? Where is he going to get a chance to come back and face him and say, hey, why did you do it to me? Now, it is said in the writings, no man lay a hand on Cain. Justice is mine, saith the Lord. In other words, Adam and Eve, if they had to hire somebody or got vindictive enough to plow Cain on his head, they don't have a right to perform the justice to satisfy Abel, who has been hurt. Where is Abel going to have a chance to resolve or be absolved from this injustice? And where is Cain is going to have a chance to face his misdeed? Unless there's extended time. And extended time may not be just one body, because now Cain is dead. Abel is dead. They're not going to meet up. Abel died before Cain. Where are they going to meet up? There's no justice now. Everybody went scot-free. Cain got off. Nobody hit him, and then he passed away. Abel died. Nobody made any justification for his death. Doesn't sound valid. Yet, creative intelligence shows that there's a validity by extending into life repetition of correction. Now, let's take another example. Cain will have to come back, and Abel will have to come back to resolve their conflict. That's extension of life. We have another example where there was a blind man, blind, literally blind. They brought him, and they who brought him were various wonderful, smart people, very intellectually trained. And they got trapped this highly realized teacher by the name of Jesus. And they brought this blind man and says, tell us, who sinned that this man be born blind? Did the man actually sin that he born blind? Or his parents sin that he born blind? Now if the man sinned that he born blind, where the hell can he go sin first and not born blind? You see? How can he sin before he's born blind? Where did he live to perform something that is bad, that he had blindness as a result and now have to be born blind? It don't make sense. Or if his parents sin that he's born blind, then there's a judgment for that. I will visit the sins of the parents of the third and fourth generation. Hereditary will take its toll. Now, if they say the parents sin that the man born blind, that's a way out for the man. And it's a way out for reincarnation too. Because that would be hereditary. But if the man sin that he's born blind, where did he sin and how did he live before to be born blind? What kind of function is this in nature? Or where is it going to be compensated? Then the realized man has to answer. If he really knows his laws of reality, and he cannot break a law, he has to put everything in the proper context. And the answer is very, very valid, very scientific, and very in-depth. Jesus said, neither, none of the two are responsible, that's when neither, for this man being blind. Didn't say that his previous life did not exist. It doesn't say that the parents' actions were not valid. He said neither of these two is the cause that the man is blind. But this is unto the glory of God. This blindness you see here is a challenge to that soul nature inherent in that form. If it's going to sell itself short of its creativeness and divinity and merely subject itself to repetitious behavior or inherited characteristics and never attempt to discover its true potential. Well, how is this true potential going to have a chance to come to its service if no other person never recognize it in them or enunciate it in them or point it out? It's never going to have a chance. And by this, the way he heals the man is indicative that he knew more of the reality and the higher potential of the man. And what he did was simply this. He spit on the ground as a sign to say how foolish you people are in your ignorance, still trying to pinpoint one aspect of God and leaving out other aspects. And that doesn't say one aspect is more important or less important. There's more in us that we don't realize. We have to go deeper yet. And then he rolls the spittle in a ball and puts it on the blind man's eye, and the blind man gets well. One can say he sanctified dirt to heal dirt. This is dirt, you know, 144 minerals, living dirt, holy dirt. Love it. And the ground you walk upon is what? Holy dirt, remove your shoes to, huh? Get a deep understanding of your true nature now, not to sell yourself short. Good. That made them realize there was more to themselves and that they can now not be hampered by harping on the idea of past life as they drag out for all the problems that are facing them, or the heredity patterns of parents, that they owe it to themselves to encounter and bring to the surface their own true spiritual potential. And the way in was meditation. That doesn't say that reincarnation is not valid. It simply says don't think it's the only way to solve all the problems, or that it's a condemnation for us to pay for our problems. It's not. It's existing as a law of encounter and resolution to a certain level of thinking, just as much as heredity exists to a certain level of thinking. But to the higher potential of your true nature, the Clark Kent that becomes a Superman by going behind the telephone booth is what you have to uncover in you. Do you follow what I'm saying?
You've got to go inside and pull off this facade of a mechanism, this verbalization, this impregnated thinking about what you think you are or what they told you you're supposed to be, and release your internal qualities.
If there are no more questions, then we'll say.